From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment.
Shake it, don't break it.
It's The Treatment. I'm here with Academy Award nominee and historically plosive star of Everything Everywhere All at Once. I saw her in SpongeBob, Stephanie Hsu. And first of all, one other thing about you also in the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel is that you're what I would call an impact player. In an ensemble, you know how to be seen. And that's quite a skill to have, that your entrance in SpongeBob, you do a split on stage, first of all.
Thank you.
Just, you know, I actually saw it.
I know.
What works so well about this for you is that you're so expressive physically, and you have the physical arrogance of a dancer, which is to say, whenever you stand, your physical posture tells us what joy is feeling, doesn't it?
It does. I am a very physical actor. I've always been very connected to the body, and the body is always my way in. This is the instrument, right? As an actor, as a performer, I am the saxophone, per se. But it's always amazing when people really pick up on that and kind of reflect back what I like to bring as a performer. It feels very comforting to feel seen in that way.
But so often, again, thinking about SpongeBob or Maisel or this movie, you walk in the way that sort of tells us who the characters are. Mm-hmm. And must be the fun about doing this, playing this character in Everything, is that she is so many different people.
Totally.
And you get to be, there's one sequence that's kind of persona shifting, that's basically sort of this movie and The Matrix and any other thing, where each costume tells us who she is, but also you get to sort of stand different too.
Totally. And the biggest joy about Jobu Tupaki, this alter ego, this villain, is that I always say that, you know, she is so powerful, she is so cool, that she doesn't even care what she's wearing. It's almost as if she is working against the outfits. She is kind of noodling her way and sort of, yeah, noodling her way throughout the many universes. And also, just, you know, because we're here in this space, let us not forget that she does come out first as Elvis. I had to say it. Come on.
Just seems to be doing a little bit of like Bjork and everybody else
yes.
in there too.
Yeah, she's everything. but it is fun. And that's a huge testament to the Daniels, our directors as well. They are also very physical beings, and not only just because we love to dance together, but they also love playing with physical humor. And so the physicality of Jobu specifically is something we really did talk a lot about internally as creative collaborators.
It's so funny because when we first meet Joy, she's in that big room in a laundromat, almost dwarfed by it. And each space she's in seems to get smaller, and she gets bigger in those spaces. And talk to me about what that was like in terms of figuring out how she would sort of inhabit those rooms.
Yeah, well, Shirley Carrotta is an amazing costume designer, our amazing costume designer. And something for Joy that we really wanted to play with was that she was being swallowed by the world and the infinite amount of feeling she was feeling. So we put her in this big oversized hoodie and a flannel on top of that. And the beauty of being an artist or a filmmaker or inside of a film versus TV is, you know, the beginning, middle, end, right? So the joy of playing Joy. Oh, you love a pun. Okay. The joy of it was that I knew that Joy was going to become this wild villain, Jobu. And I knew that villain underneath was actually still Joy and was going to end up having this very intimate, vulnerable conversation with her mother in the parking lot, back as Joy again. So because I knew the scope of where she was going, I wanted her to be the smallest degree possible.
She is so small when we first see her.
Yeah.
Yeah, but not only that, but her shoulders are hunched. She's sort of like peering up a little bit at
totally.
Everybody.
Yeah.
You make her physically smaller.
Yes, totally. I just completely allow myself to feel swallowed. That was definitely intentional because I knew that what was to come also was someone who was so powerful and so omniscient, omnipresent. That's the joy, right? That's the, oh my gosh, I gotta stop saying joy. That
is, that's the exhilaration, if you will. That is the pleasure.
The pleasure. Yes, there we go.
There are a few other words we can use here, but I'm thinking so often, again, your entrance in Mrs.
Historically
Maisel.
Historically explosive.
There you
it's
go.
True. That, it, plosive.
It's true. Explosive. In so many ways. But I think to me, you're interested in the Maisel where she walks in with her shoulders back and her head held up and looking around at everything. Talking a mile a minute, but constantly observing, that's a real showpiece of an entrance. And so often she gets out those kinds of entrances into rooms.
Yeah, I know. I feel really lucky that I feel like I've been working with a lot of collaborators who really let me play in a way, and they guide me within that play space. But I think that Amy and Dan Sherman Palladino, they really encourage that strength. I feel like I've worked with collaborators, including Tina Landau, director of SpongeBob, and Daniels, Amy and Dan.
Or Be More Chill for
Or
that
Be
matter.
More Chill, Stephen Brackett. I've worked with directors who want to really celebrate characters that are messy but powerful and someone we've never seen before. And I really love creating characters that we've never seen before and that are surprising and new. I feel so grateful for the directors I've worked with who've allowed that to come through and pulled the thread on that. I mean, SpongeBob, which is so wild, I was a part of the first ever table read of that potential
musical. What was that like?
I didn't have an agent at the time. I didn't want an agent. I was doing downtown theater and thought that that was going to be my life and was happy and joyful that exhilarating. It was exhilarating. I loved it. I was bartending, all the stuff. I was giving, you know, kind of, sort of quintessential New York artist life. And then I got pulled into a table read in the Viacom building of the first ever.
Isn't the Viacom building? So it's basically SpongeBob headquarters?
Yeah, it was SpongeBob headquarters. It was not even Equity. It was not a union reading. It was like they just wanted to hear out loud what a SpongeBob musical might be and if it was something worth investing in. Tina Landau, our director, was already attached. So they had a room full of actors. It was a 2-day read through of this script.
So, well, there's so many people that I can see it. Would have been a 2-day read-through.
Yeah, totally. And that was the first moment I met Tina. That was in 2012 or 2013. I was three people who ended up developing it for 5 years from that table read to the Broadway premiere. So many of those characters in that musical I helped create, even though at the end I played the computer. You know, I had played all the other characters that ended up being cast to other people.
No kidding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the musical took so many different shapes at different points. And because I was with the project for so long, we really co-created that together.
Well, it's funny because clearly going back to, you know, Awkwafina's Nora from Queens, this idea of workshopping, because that's a show that in effect kind of workshops from episode to episode.
Yes.
What the Daniels do in terms of using space is there's that sense of trying to figure out where the gravity is in the space, and then you go from being the corner of the frame to the center of the frame. So there's all this kind of idea of workshopping, as you were talking about SpongeBob, clearly that was a part of it too. So essentially you are that kind of collaborator who wants to be a part of something from the ground up, aren't you?
I completely am. I came from a background of devising theater where we're all, maybe we have one concept and maybe the concept is like an apple. And then we sit on the floor in a black box theater and we think about what an apple means, and then we create a 1-hour piece about it. You know, that's, and then like an interpretive dance about an apple, and it's amazing. And I'm reducing it right now just to be funny, but that really is, to me, like the bones of collaborating, and that is what I was taught to do, what I love to do. If you haven't seen that episode of Nora from Queens, for those who are listening, it's amazing.
Thank you for those who are listening.
Yeah, thank you. It's such a testament to the Daniels, really. Like that episode has so little budget. You wouldn't imagine what you end up seeing on screen. You wouldn't see that on the page. That comes from the minds of the Daniels, from who they bring on to work with them. And it really was there that we truly and honestly felt like falling in love. I was like, oh my gosh, these are my people.
By the way, it's the treat. My guest is Stephanie Hsu, the Oscar-nominated Kuna co-stars of the Daniels film, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. But because Brecht to me, it sort of describes the way all these sort of collaborations you've done have worked, which is basically sort of dealing with expectation
yes.
versus the physical space.
Yeah.
And that really is, because you think about, I hate to do this to you, the character of Karen, who exists yeah. as a disembodied voice.
He means people... Karen the computer.
Oh, yes, public radio. You might not know SpongeBob SquarePants. Yeah. Forgive my imprecision. But I, to take something also, in so many ways, like, people feel they own Michelle Yeoh, and people feel they own Karen in some way. So to step into a space where people have these kind of proprietary feelings, which is to say dealing with expectation, which is to say being incredibly Brechtian about it, if you will. Is that the way you've always sort of looked at theater, that examination of the audience expectation versus what you're going to give them?
You know, it's funny, which is kind of Brechtian, actually, is that I think I try not to think about the audience. I try to actually first go into the story and try to understand what the story wants to be. But I do like to play with extreme reversal or extreme, like, just flipping something on its head just to test it out. And for me, whenever I come across a project, first I have to feel if I feel any sort of emotional or spiritual connection to the story or to the character. And then I like to just explode it. Like, I like to throw paint on the wall. I like to stretch it so far and find the corners of that character there. And I say I don't care about the audience. It's not exactly what I mean.
But they're not your first concerns.
They're not my first concerns, because I think if I were to do that, then I would probably end up accidentally pigeonholing myself into what I think they might like, as opposed to how I think we all could be surprised, or how newness can come to our experiences of story. It's kind of like, I can't be the algorithm, if that makes any sense. I can't condition myself to communicate or execute what I think might be palatable to people, because if I do that, then I am not serving our art form or our collective societal capacity to be surprised.
Sure, but as you say that, I find myself thinking about so many of these characters that you played have been, exist to be kind of an abrasion, which is to say, and that's in that aspect completely Brechtian, mm-hmm. which is sort of like make yeah. audiences think about what it is they're reacting to.
Yeah.
And, I mean, again, we go from Karen to Maze Lusso, everything. I mean, there are all these things about sort of making people substantially uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's why maybe the Daniels and I are really good artistic soulmates, because so this woman, Liz Suedos, was my biggest mentor.
Elizabeth Suedos?
Elizabeth Suedos.
I should know who is.
Oh, my
Elizabeth
God.
Suedos.
Okay. You're a theater buff.
Sorry.
Okay.
I've gone once or twice.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Liz was my mama. I met her kind of the first year I moved to New York. She took me under her wing. That's who I was working with, like, all my formative years in New York. We traveled together. I, like, assistant directed for her. She was my mentor. And so for those of you who don't know Liz, one of her most famous pieces of work was Runaways, where she took actual runaway teenagers from the streets of New York, brought them into a room at La Mama on East 4th Street, and they developed a musical together about their stories as runaway youth. That ended up going to the public, and then it ended up transferring to Broadway. And a lot of the original teenagers that she literally met off the streets of New York ended up going to Broadway as well for the production. So she was my teacher. She taught me that the art that you make must be for goodness, and it can and should be subversive and strange and wild and exceed, like, surpass our comfort zones. But ultimately, it should be in service for what we hope to be a better humanity.
But so much of that, Elizabeth, forgive me, she's not Liz Suedos to me. Forgive my formality here, is about forcing audiences to reckon with the quotidian.
Yes.
And their response to that.
Yeah.
And that's a big part of what everything is too.
So yeah.
These spaces that are the everyday.
Yeah.
In fact, so many things these guys have done.
Farting corpse.
Yes. About reckoning with what you think, something you think you know,
yeah,
and subverting your expectation about that.
And also, I think, you know, the Daniels get a lot of flack for the butt plugs, the farting, the all the things that are, I don't know if butt plugs is going to be bleeped, but, you know, whatever, all the things that are uncomfortable. But I think they like doing that. And I love them for that, because there are so many things that we have written off as not societally acceptable. And I feel like they really like to push those boundaries, not to test you and not from a place of ego, but just from a place of like, how funny that this rule was made. Why was this rule made? Like, it's okay. Everybody farts. Like, maybe it's okay. It's okay. And I think that that space of uncomfortability or exploding that open, it actually opens up more space for vulnerability and the mess of humanity, right? Like, it's so easy to put on your nice coat, your smart person hat, and walk about the world like you know everything. But actually, what the Daniels pose is that maybe we don't know anything at all, but we're just trying to figure it out. And how can we make art from that place?
Well, we've gone from being circle closer to Everybody Farts with my guest Stephanie Hsu, the Oscar nominee for her terrific work in
my
the film Everything Everywhere All at Once. It's a treatment. More to come. Stay with us. It's the treatment. My guest is Oscar nominee Stephanie Hsu for her work in the film By the Daniels, Everything Everywhere All at Once. I guess I should ask you this, though, as we're talking about these things. If you consider yourself to be primarily a musical person or more per se, because there's a musicality in the way these characters talk. I mean, for Maisel's, it's almost like operetta. It's almost like Gilbert and Sullivan. That's the constancy of verbiage, but finding a rhythm that sort of subverts what that verbiage is. Versus here, before she speaks, we can almost hear her take a breath as if she's waiting for the exact right moment to say something and working on her own schedule. And there's a count to that, a rhythm. And I wonder, you think about these characters in terms of that kind of musical count.
I'm not a musical theater person, even though I've been in musicals.
Okay, maybe one.
But my teachers were all like jazz musicians and improvisatory music people. And growing up, I loved music. I also love poetry. And I think that might be just inherently something that is in my bones. Every character catches different waves. So I think every character inherently falls into different rhythms and different musicalities.
But these characters you play all have very different rhythms.
Yes, totally. But I think that's also, it's not intentional in the sense of I'm not thinking about them musically. I think that their spirit just comes through in a very specific kind of way each time. And of course, I have awareness of speed and tempo in how they speak, but it's not something that's calculated.
Basically, what you're saying is you're finding your way to the character. So it's this intersection of sort of the method and Brecht, which is really interesting.
Totally. I think it's method. I care deeply about craft coupled alongside complete surrender. You know, you do all your homework. You really get into the weeds on your own time so that when you show up, you can completely just fly and trust that things are going to come through that you couldn't possibly calculate. That's the way I like to work.
So you're saying poetry. Which poets did you read growing up?
When I was living in New York, I loved Frank O'Hara so much. And there's this piece on him in The New Yorker. I think it was published. It was after he passed away. I think it was published in the 50s or 60s. And it talked about he was coming up in a time where poets were like ballet dancers, and ballet dancers were like jazz musicians. Musicians were like journalists. He's talking about a community in New York where people from all different mediums were really intersecting and how it informed everybody else's mediums. And I love that. I think that piece about Frank O'Hara really inspired me to be continuously rigorous of other people's mediums. My biggest fear is to ever just become an actor. I feel like in order to stay vibrant in my own practice, I have to be deeply curious about other forms, and that makes this medium even richer and more complex. Anis Mojgani is one of my favorite poets. He's the poet laureate of Oregon, incredible spoken word poet.
But both of these people you're talking about, both these poets deal in abrasion too. It's interesting to hear you talk about these things of
therapist.
I'm going to analyze myself too, but also this sort of regard for trying to make a spark and seeing how that works rather than regard for audience. I mean, mm-hmm. because there is that sort of divide that Brecht has talked about mm-hmm. between the stage and the audience. I mean, all these things you're talking mm-hmm. about are connected in some way.
It's true. I mean, I would say that, like, I wouldn't consider myself inherently Brechtian, because I would say that Frank and Anis, let's throw in Mary Oliver there for good measure, but just because you can't not, you know? I mean, she's just incredible. But when you think about these three poets, for example, there is so much heart to them. There is so much wonder.
But there's so much hurt in there, too, though.
There's so much hurt, completely. And through that hurt, there's also, it's hurt alongside magic, alongside wonder. There's a little bit of melancholy, which I do love.
A little bit of melancholy with Frank O'Hara.
Yeah. It's way more heart than I would. And Brecht, I feel like, is trying to remove emotion. And I feel like, for me, I love the pathos. I love that. I love catharsis, actually. I love feeling alive in that way through art.
Well, we're getting epistemological here with my guest, Stephanie Chu, the Oscar nominee for Everything Everywhere All at Once. It's The Treatment, by the way, which you can also hear at kcrw.com/thetreatment. Let's talk about this thing that I find fascinating about you as an actor, which is the way you find to play confidence and characters' regard. And the one thing that links everything we're talking about here is regard, whether you're sort of trashing that regard, I don't want to say trashing, but making audiences ask questions about that regard in the way that Brecht did, or sort of the regard of audiences as part of the continuum, which is what Frank O'Hara and all those poets you're talking about, they all do that. Talk about the way you find to play confidence, because she does we should say a 360. There's 180 by two-thirds in, but by the end, it's back to where she was, but informed by that sadness. So talk about the confidence that you find to play her.
I knew how confident that Jobu was going to get to be. And I feel like people like seeing me confident because, you know, I'm like 4'11 and 3/4 tall, let's say 5 feet if you want to round up. I'm tiny. I'm like kind of silly in real life, but I, for some reason, have this wealth of power inside me. So I feel like people are really satisfied to get to see little old me be strong and tough and ha-da-da-da-da-da, talking a mile a minute. But what was so amazing about Everything Everywhere was that I got to show this side that is also messy, imperfect, quiet also. That's something I would like to continue to surprise people about. However, I do feel really grateful that I have had the opportunities to step into these characters that are very powerful and very powerful women, because for Jobu, for example, something we really wanted to do was create a villain that had a very strong emotional core and also got to be completely grotesque and vile, like legs spread out wide, the way that people who've played the Joker can do, but not a lot of women get to be kind of disgusting or spilled out and unabashedly vile in that way. We wanted to make a woman that was scary. Sigourney Weaver, actually. So at the AFI luncheon, she told Key, she was like, "Where's your daughter? I want to meet your daughter." And so Key comes up and was like, "Sigourney wants to meet you." And I said, "Okay." And so Key pulled me over. And the first thing Sigourney Weaver said to me was, "I'm kind of afraid of you." Yeah, I guess that means I did my job. But when I first watched the movie, I was also afraid of me. And I found myself so worried that people would be so afraid of Jobu that they wouldn't be able to understand her. Because I was realizing, wow, I have never seen that actually in film. It's so rare to see characters go there, and specifically female characters go there.
When you take this back to Awkwafina and mm-hmm. the idea of playing with archetype, and expectations of Asian characters mm-hmm. and Asian female character comes into all this too.
Yeah.
And there's also a pleasure you take as an actor in your voice, which I've always found really interesting. These characters delight in the boldness of their speaking choices. Mm-hmm. Again, when she's Jobu and just sort of like waiting, it becomes almost this test of the audience. How long can we wait until she will speak?
Yeah.
And then the last, not the last word, but the last two or three words.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, again, that's why I ask about musicality in this, because there is a sort of
One of the directions that the Daniels gave me is, how can you literally in one character be everything everywhere all at once? So oftentimes we would take a scene, and when we were working with it, a vocabulary that we developed was being able to verse jump literally in the middle of a scene, but it's not written that way. The Daniels would just say, okay, now break the scene and as Jobu. And so I would be doing it as scripted, but some of those pauses come from the experience of her sometimes literally just going elsewhere and then coming back and giving her permission to actually access all frequencies instantaneously. And then, you know, of course, what I say about like craft and surrender, it's that beautiful thing with Jobu that you get to do as a performer side by side, where when I catch wind of that frequency of being able to enter a different plane as a character, me as the actor gets to meet that impulse and say like, oh, we just got distracted. Let's live there for a second and then bring it back, you know? So that was really fun. I mean, that was the most fun thing about her character, was it actually asked me to be completely alive. Like normally if you're filming and someone on the crew drops a pencil, you as an actor might say like, I have to stay in it. But as Jobu, everything is a possibility. And so it was so fun to just be completely vibrant and quadra infinite dimensional and be so alive in the practical space as well, that anything is material to work on and actually works to bring her chaos, her grounded but manic chaos, to life.
You so often play characters who've been not as aware as Jobu, but pretty aware anyway. Mm. These characters whose antenna are constantly sort of vibrating as to what's going on around them.
And maybe that comes from the experimental theater background, where none of this is real and is not in a vacuum, especially coming from, you can't do that on Broadway if someone coughs, unless you're like Patti LuPone and someone's phone goes off. You can be like, hey, stop the show. I'm not really there yet, you know? but, you know, also I came from a world of comedy too. So when I was in college, I was in a sketch group and, you know, did a lot of improv as well. And so there's something about that of like, I am on the stage, but I'm not pretending you're not in the audience, right? Like there's actually so much to be mined from that connection and the acknowledgement that we're all breathing the same air. And then to bring that to life in characters on camera, I think having that antennas, that to me is where that unspeakable magic comes, where you have to, as an actor, as an artist, I always say you have to be kind of like an open portal or vessel to allow things to come through you too. And if you ignore those antenna or what's alive around you, then I think that can silo you from so much inspiration that is available at every moment.
Clearly we have nothing left to talk about, but you extend you an invitation to come back here anytime you'd like.
It'd
be a thrill to have you back. My guest is Stephanie Hsu. She's one of the Oscar-nominated stars and Best Supporting Actress. One day we'll get rid of that category. For Everything Everywhere All at Once, I can't thank you enough for doing this. It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you so much. This was awesome.
Using shape-shifting powers that have taken her from playing a computer on stage to a morally flexible force in the movies, has taken Stephanie Hsu to an Oscar nomination with Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. Hear previous treatment episodes at kcrw.com/thetreatment. Always charting change. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. The last time my guest, Sam Wasson, was here is with this terrific book on the making of Chinatown, The Big Goodbye, Chinatown, and The Last Years of Hollywood. Apparently, there are more last years of Hollywood to get into, because in his new book, the co-author with Janine Basinger, Hollywood, The Oral History, there's a ton of things to get into. And it's so funny because I read the book just before I saw Babylon. I will say this about Babylon. One of the things that the movie touches on that we get a great deal of in the book is that the silent era was a really fertile period for women directors, which you don't hear much about.
Yeah. The business didn't know what it was. You know, Janine, my co-writer, says, when the business was born, it wasn't a boy and it wasn't a girl. they just needed all hands on deck. So man, woman, write a script, hold a camera, get in front of the camera, whatever we got, just jump in. It was a great big improvisation.
So much of it reminds me of pickup basketball. You just walk by a court and see people, well, I can do that.
Exactly. Yes. It was. I mean, Hollywood's such a big part of our lives. It's amazing to even think that there was a moment when this thing didn't know what it was. And that's part of the thrill of the early days. It was pickup basketball.
I guess I just find myself thinking, too, so often in the book, we get a chance to sort of hear this thing. And I actually just did a conversation in Rotterdam over the weekend with Steve McQueen, who said something that basically echoed the book. He said that what he loves about the movie business is that, it's an art, but it's also a trade. And the first third of the book is really people outlining that it's exactly that. Not only was it a trade, but it was a trade that was being invented in real time, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. And it's still being invented or being uninvented, being destroyed. But yeah, this thing is so complicated. It can't be codified. You know, once you've mastered, it's not like building a car or building a piece of technology where you can actually learn and get better at it. Every film is a work of art or a work of entertainment. And so you kind of have to throw everything out when you start over again. Same goes for the business. It's always vulnerable to changes in technology, business, culture, politics, you know, more so than most any other industries, just by virtue of how expensive it is, how ambitious every undertaking is. I mean, every movie is an army. It's so hard to sort of put it under glass and say, okay, we know exactly what this is. We can control all of the elements. And that was even more extreme in those early days, for sure.
Well, I just have to say, you'd be hard-pressed to find any publication that ranges from quotes from Leo McCarey to Jordan Peele.
We wanted to be, like, so enormous. We wanted to do this crazy thing, which was tell the whole story in between two covers. So thank you, Elvis. That's good. I'm glad.
But it's thrilling, though, to see that, because it really is, on a certain level, about this kind of rapt fascination that touches everybody from Mitchell Lyson to Michael Ovitz. I mean, there is this sense of beholding this thing that's eminently approachable, but inevitably something bigger than you. And that comes at some point from anybody who talks more than twice in the book, doesn't it?
It is awesome. I mean, movies are awesome. I mean, I think the fact that, like, they've sunk so low and we're still going, you know, we're still hungry for movies. Hollywood does keep ending, you know, it does keep getting worse. People say, oh, you know, everyone always likes, there's this kind of fun parlor game in Hollywood. When did it really end? What was the exact moment when it fell apart? But it keeps falling apart and we still keep going. And that is to your point, I think, that this, we can't get away from this thing. It's like this marriage that just won't end, because even when everything else is lost, we still remember this one thing that we love about the other person. We still remember this moment when we met, and we're always trying to go back and rekindle that flame.
Finally, the movie business is about blind faith. And I thought about this because my late friend John Singleton is in the book. There's something about his story that takes me back to the beginnings of the industry. And then there's a great sort of quote from him when he talks about the coverage of the Boys in the Hood script said that he has a no talent.
First of all, I should say anyone interested in Singleton should go directly to the AFI library and read this interview with Singleton. He goes play by play from film school to getting Boys in the Hood up and running. And it is a perfect Hollywood dream story. Like you're saying, Elvis, going from this hopeless feeling of nobody likes me, I'm never going to get this thing made, nobody understands it, to by this gold rush miracle of luck and talent, becoming one of the hottest directors on the planet. It's one of my favorite parts of the book.
By the way, it's a treatment. My guest is our old friend, Sam Watson, who co-authored the terrific book with Jeanine Basinger, the book Hollywood, The Oral History. When sound came in, nobody knew what to do and nobody knew where to look. Also, by that point, the business was getting bigger, too. It seemed like it was full of possibility, but it looked like there's also suddenly there's a ceiling.
that struck me as being really interesting, and the way you guys sort of really laid out and through these great interviews, these nuggets you guys continually pull out. I mean, that's the fun of reading the book, is that it's so full of that.
What's cool about talking about this book is I can actually praise it without being like self-serving, because we didn't write it. You know what I mean? Like, I can join you in saying how cool this is. But that's why we were so drawn to this, because we thought, okay, the story of Hollywood, like any great historical story, has been subject to so much misinterpretation, so much misreading, because Hollywood carries so many of our broken dreams and our realized dreams. So it's very emotional, the Hollywood story, even for people who aren't in it. And so what was so exciting to Janine and I about the prospect of these interviews is we could say, all right, look, here are the people who were there. Don't shoot the messenger. And hopefully we can move towards some kind of agreement about what this place really was, which is not a perfect place, obviously, a place with all kinds of problems, obviously. But like you were saying, Elvis, I mean, like, we dealt with sound, a place of incredible creativity. You know, we built the industry. That took ingenuity and teamwork of all kinds. And I think that comes across in these interviews. You know, the enthusiasm, the fun that these people had making Hollywood. Janine likes to say what we call old Hollywood, you know, which was the studio era, was characterized by fun, family, and flexibility. And that came through time and again in these interviews.
So often with our oral histories, you know this from reading as many, probably more than I have, is that a lot of them seem to be fixated on the anecdote rather than offering a sense of perspective and point of view. And I think that's key to the way that this book is shaped, that we, as often as we're getting anecdote, we are getting people's really feeling about what all these things mean.
We wanted to tell a bigger story that transcended anecdote, like you said. You know, this isn't just sitting around having a good time talking about our favorite moments of Hollywood. We were looking for the themes, and we could find them because we had this archive of 4,000 interviews virtually. So time and time again, these things did emerge. And when they did, we would, you know, it would be like settling on a puzzle piece. Oh, this is good. This echoes what, you know, Robert Wise said over here, or Fred Zinnemann said over here. Let's put that aside and see if it fits into the bigger picture. I don't know if we could have done that if we didn't have so many interviews. It might have just descended into anecdotage, like you said. There may be less likely that the puzzle pieces would fit as nicely as they did.
One of the things, Sam, I got to tell you, I really love about the book, and we've talked about this, is what you do, is what you're attracted to, I think, as kind of a cultural historian, is that moment where an era is passing and people sort of seeing the dying of the light around them. And it happens so often in this that it's almost kind of like the cultural version of Groundhog Day.
Yeah. That's great.
I wonder if that was one of the things that attracted you to this, because thematically it offers you a chance to sort of, people talk about, they think of it as being the dying of the light, but it's not. It's just the Emperor's catch someplace else in the area.
Yeah, I mean, what's the difference between loss and change? Can Hollywood change and stay as good? I mean, theoretically, yes, something can change and stay as good. But my personal feeling is that we've been looking over, you know, the story of Hollywood is change and depreciation. And whether that's my own personal theme that I'm working out in Hollywood, or whether that's objectively true is, I guess, for people to argue, you know, my position is clear. I'm publishing this. I do believe Hollywood does keep getting worse and worse and worse. As Hollywood is my subject, it's inevitable that anytime I set out to write a book about the last 50 years, let's say since, you know, since Chinatown, give or take, I'm going to have to deal with that. I'm going to have to deal with the fact that fewer and fewer movies are being distributed on the big screen. And that seems undeniable. The arguable part is whether they're getting better or worse. I certainly think they're getting worse. I certainly think that the community is getting thinner and thinner. And so for me, it is a great, can I say, cri de coeur, that is a big part of the second half of the book. It is a rise and fall story.
I have to say, too, that it was fascinating to see how often directors, not just directors, I should say, when people talk about that moment of not quite knowing what they're doing. That happens so often in this book. I wonder if that was something that you guys sort of thought, it's interesting to keep this kind of idea alight, that you may have all the confidence in the world, but at some point you're still learning, and it's a business that demands learning and constantly being open to what is ahead of you instead of trying to force it into an ideal, right?
What people kept saying, what people kept reiterating throughout 100 years of interviews, going back from Lillian Gish to today, you know, was some version of the William Goldman, "Nobody Knows Anything." Many people quoted it directly, attributing it to Goldman. And there's a whole run in the book where I just have one person after the next basically saying the same thing over and over. And I think it goes on for pages. It may go on like 4 pages of like, "Nobody knows anything. Nobody knows anything." And this is the terror of the business. But as you, I think, are saying, it's the glory of the business. And it should be true of any art form that nobody knows anything. Imagine if everyone did know everything. Then it would be formula. It would be color by numbers. And I dare say that seems to be the direction that we're going in. You know, I mean, art is about the unconscious. It's about seeing the future. It's about all of these things we don't understand or semi-understand. And the minute we think we get it, well, now we're dealing with dead material. And it's got to be the same for democracy. We always have to be in a situation of, who are we? What do we do next? The country keeps changing. It has to be an improvisation of, what are you going to say? What am I going to say? Someone else jumps into the fold. Well, what are they going to say? We have to be in a state of yes and, to borrow the improviser's term. Because the minute we're not open to this new input, we're calcified and we're dealing with something that's dead and we don't know it yet. And that's the truth to survival of any kind.
There's a strain of some people not thinking as well as others, as well of others as they could. And there's a famous costume designer, a multiple Oscar, and whose name I'm not going to give away here, who sort of admits to her, how best to put this? Some might call it perfidy. Let's say her inventiveness in getting into the movie business and then being called out on it by several other people.
Isn't that great?
But I also find something too, because there's so many people, I mean, you're talking about people who had to sort of admit that they were learning the business. And I was really, if I'm myself, struck by George Cukor's admission of his diffidence and finding it, but also being sort of struck by working with certain actors. And I have to say, you got two of my favorite directors in here. One was run down by one of the people in the book, in fact, Mitchell Eisen, who, as we know, Billy Wilder didn't think much of, but I think Easy Living is kind of a perfect movie.
Me too.
And John Cromwell, who I pretty much feel like Algiers is stolen from Street of Chance, an old movie of his. And I just love that there are these people whose names have been either disappeared or been derided. I mean, certainly you've got Robert Wise talking about the real story behind how Orson Welles came to do Citizen Kane. But to have these kinds of stories about the fundamental of the movie business and having Lyson, who went from being doing costumes to directing movies, and I think doing an estimable job. And I hate to say, you can sort of feel a little bit of intolerance in Billy Wilder's assessment of him.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Billy was a crank and a curmudgeon, and you know, if you love him, you love that about him. And other people say, you know, his movies are sour and curdled. But I'm glad you brought up Mitchell Lyson. I mean, I'm late to the party on that. Did he do Remember the Night?
Yes.
What a wonderful movie that is. Fred McMurray and Barbara Stanwyck. I just saw it not too long ago, and it was so exciting to me. John Cromwell, I don't know a lot about, but in the course of writing this book, I kind of got into John Brahm, the director. Yes. John Brahm. You know, that's another one that I got turned on to. And one of the fun things for me about this was to listen to, you know, was the biographical aspect of these individuals. Like, I would read Brahm and I would go, wow, this guy's so cool. Just by virtue of listening to him. And I kind of got on to him. And so there are all these little discoveries that I made on a person-to-person basis. Even a guy like Charlton Heston, who I sort of don't take seriously because of the goofiness, you know, of the performances, and to say nothing of the politics. But when you read Heston, he's so smart. And he is such a great observer of acting, and Orson Welles in particular. I mean, Heston's view of Touch of Evil is just one of the most thrilling, you know, front row seats to Orson that I've ever had.
Oh, sure. And it also shows how eager he was to sort of pay attention. Because you, just from what you know of seeing Charlton Heston in movies, you think he comes in with his opinions already formed. But clearly he knew he was in the hands of a master. And he just sort of sat back and took it all in, didn't he?
Yeah, and I didn't know this. Now, Janine, who was on the AFI board with, you know, who served with Charlton Heston, who fondly refers to him as Chuckles, she always said, wait till you get to Heston, you'll be surprised. I said, he was just a friend to yours, you know, no. And she was absolutely right. Heston was, he just spoke in beautiful sentences like a writer, my God. Now, one of the disappointments for me personally was Minnelli, who I love. I think we all love Minnelli. I don't think any, you know, I think we can all agree.
Yeah, he's one of those people who, the more you read in the book, the more he's sort of picked apart by
other people. Yes. He was such a bad interview, Minnelli. My God. I mean, he could not put a sentence together. But of course, then you start to think, wait a second, this is a guy who is purely cinematic, purely visual. Language means nothing to this guy. So as bad as he is as a verbal communicator, he's great as a visual communicator. Of course, that didn't help us at all. But, you know, I was disappointed. I wish we had more Minnelli, you know, and I wish we had more Nicholas Ray, you know, and there are people we don't have. We don't have Cary Grant.
I was wondering if that was intentional. It seems to me that you make the choice to sort of let the people who are responsible for shaping this, is there anything else, tell the story. But also, I can imagine, too, it would have to be kind of difficult to find things from Cary Grant that he hadn't been, stories that hadn't been told ad infinitum, for example.
Well, the fact is we were limited by what existed. You know, simply Cary Grant didn't do an AFI oral history, you know, neither did Jimmy Stewart, you know, where we didn't have the giants, you know, we felt, well, we can't do the history of Hollywood without representing Cary Grant or Jimmy Stewart, you know, or whomever, you know. So there we had other people speaking about Cary Grant, which I think was just as fascinating. And you really get a picture of Cary Grant that is a little more complicated than the normal Cary Grant. I think we have McCary talking about how he wasn't actually so easy to work with.
Yeah, which was shocking to me.
It was shocking to me, too. It was totally shocking to me, too. So, and we also have, you know, we don't have Marilyn, but we have Nunnally Johnson talking about Marilyn. We have Charles Lemaire talking about Marilyn. We get these people who aren't commonly on the record. And so we ended up getting a freshness to these portraits that you wouldn't necessarily have if you were getting, you know, the first person account, Marilyn on Marilyn, for instance.
Well, tell one of the things that actually sort of speaks to what we're talking about here, which is a first person account, which is Meryl Streep talking about her first day on the set with Jane Fonda and telling that story, which is a kind of a story that you don't normally get from Meryl Streep, because some people are usually so awestruck by her, to hear her talk about being awestruck by somebody else.
Now, that's one of the virtues of the environment in which these interviews were conducted. Because they were conducted in classroom environments for the conservatory students and allowed to go on sometimes 2 hours, you could transcend the soundbite. You know, you can actually get into an improvisational place with these interviews, and they can get into areas they didn't normally get into before. And this is a perfect example, is Meryl Streep entering the scene of Julia. And also, because we had Jane Fonda, we could also create a sort of a back and forth between Meryl and Jane Fonda. And if I'm not mistaken, I think even Fred Zinnemann. So it's one of those passages in the book where you have the principals all talking about the same thing as if they were really in the room together, which, of course, they weren't.
Yeah, and that goes from those guys to then Streep and Cimino, mm-hmm. and talking about the Deer Hunter, ending with Streep saying, Cimino's good. He listens. Everybody seems to hate him, and I don't know why. Again, I think the real strength of the book is not just the anecdotes. And I should say there are a bunch of terrific, priceless anecdotes in the book. We get a point of view from these people who are talking. So we understand how they see things, how the stuff impacted them. And you want that because we don't want this to be just some sort of quote-unquote sort of authoritarian, stentorian piece of storytelling. But that's not even what you're interested in anyway. If anybody's read your work, they would know that.
The line about Streep on Cimino, you know, Janine and I, wherever possible, we're looking towards, obviously, we're out to tell one great story here, but where we would find something revelatory about a character like Cimino, and these people are characters in our story, well, you don't think of Cimino as a guy who listens. I mean, you think of Cimino as Heaven's Gate, famously not listening as the money is hemorrhaging out of the United Artists. So when I saw that, I thought, okay, well, that's such a nice thing here. And so that you picked up on that is just really wonderful to hear, because for a second, that kind of brings Cimino to life in a way that he isn't always. So I'm glad you got that, Elvis.
We're out of time, but it's always terrific to talk to our guest, Sam Watson. His new book, co-author with Janine Basinger, is Hollywood, Their Old History. Sam, again, thanks so much for doing this.
Elvis, thank you sincerely. It made me feel great. Thank you.
Cultural historian Sam Watson, writing with Janine Basinger on the shifts of momentum that created the new book, Hollywood and Oral History. Previous looks at Hollywood and other cultural institutions at kcrw.com/thetreatment. This is The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treat from director Casey Lemons, who recently brought us Whitney Houston, I Want to Dance with Somebody. Her treat, a writer who taught her well and led the way.
I'm Casey Lemons, and this is The Treat. Toni Morrison was a big influence on me, and Gabriel Garcia Marquez, absolutely. 100 Years of Solitude was a big influence. And I think because it was a family story and there was magic realism and those things combined, I found very evocative. And I thought, you know, I had this family drama in my mind for a long time. And I knew that it had magic realism elements. And I think I was very, very inspired by Marquez.
Jose Arcadio Buendia spent the long months of the rainy season shut up in a small room that he had built in the rear of the house so that no one would disturb his experiments.
Toni was very important to me. She's one of my high priestess goddesses, Toni, and the way that magic realism could exist in kind of a dusty environment and real American and very, very Black and very authentic feeling, that really moved me about Toni.
I have long despised artists' chatter about muses, voices that speak to them and enable a vision, the source of which they could not otherwise name.
But I think it's Song of Solomon. I believe that's the book I read first, and I believe that's the one that really made this take off in me, the flight of imagination and magic realism and dusty family stories and quite tragic stories, right, that she was a huge influence, I would say, between Toni Morrison and Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
He carried a letter from me in his coat pocket for years and years, and drove through blinding snowstorms to help me.
You know, complicated characters that are neither super heroic or they're heroic in an interesting way if they're heroic. And they have, they're very, very flawed characters. I think that that's also quite present in all of her work.
Smart, high spirit.
I met her because I wanted to do love. Now there's a haunting book. She said to me something really interesting. She said, a movie is as much like a book as a poem is like a book. And I thought that was really interesting. Stuck with me.
The clouds looked at each other, then broke apart in confusion. Fish heard their hooves as they raced off to carry the news of the scatterbrained river to the peaks of hills and the tops of the champion daisy trees.
Tar Baby was a really important book for me, honestly. The same way Baldwin really opened my mind to being able to write different types of characters from different economic echelons and white and black characters equally effectively and beautifully. That's very present in Tar Baby. And, you know, kind of was a really magical thing for me to read. It's like, wow, like this is life and yet magical.
Director Casey Lemons, whose directorial debut, East Bayou, recently celebrated its 25th anniversary with The Treat, a writer whose influence shaped that story. This and every installment of The Treat available at kcrw.com/The Treat. And since it's awards season, why not catch up on interviews with nominees and winners at kcrw.com/FYC. The Treat, an exploration of the minds and hearts of creators from every field of endeavor, on the winners who helped them break through and shape their careers. This week's show, shaped by Rebecca Mooney, who produces and edits the program, and Katie Gilchrist, who mixes it. Help this week from Anna Buss and Laura Kandarajan. I'm Elvis Mitchell. To better days, everyone, it's The Treatment.